The Blue Sequin by R. Austin Freeman, Part 2. As we were returning down the line, we passed a working man who seemed to be viewing the chairs and sleepers with more than casual interest. "That, I suppose, is one of the plate layers," Thorndyke suggested to the station master. "Yes, the foreman of the gang," was the reply. "I'll just step back and have a word with him if you will walk on slowly." And my colleague turned back briskly and overtook the man, with whom he remained in conversation for some minutes. "I think I see the police inspector on the platform," remarked Thorndyke as we approached the station. "Yes, there he is," said our guide. "Come down to see what you are after, sir, I expect." Which was doubtless the case, although the officer professed to be there by the merest chance. "You would like to see the weapon, sir, I suppose," he remarked when he had introduced himself. "The umbrella spike," Thorndyke corrected. "Yes, if I may. We are going to the mortuary now." "Then you'll pass the station on the way, so if you care to look in, I will walk up with you." This proposition being agreed to, we all proceeded to the police station, including the station master, who was on the very tiptoe of curiosity. "There you are, sir," said the inspector, unlocking his office and ushering us in. "Don't say we haven't given every facility to the defense. There are all the effects of the accused, including the very weapon the deed was done with." "Come, come," protested Thorndyke. "We mustn't be premature." He took the stout ash staff from the officer, and having examined the formidable spike through a lens, drew from his pocket a steel caliper gauge, with which he carefully measured the diameter of the spike and the staff to which it was fixed. "And now," he said, when he had made a note of the measurements in his book, "we will look at the color box and the sketch. Ha! A very orderly man, your brother, Mr. Stopford. Tubes all in their places, palette knives wiped clean, palette cleaned off and rubbed bright, brushes wiped. They ought to be washed before they stiffen. All this is very significant." He unstrapped the sketch from the blank canvas to which it was pinned, and standing it on a chair in a good light, stepped back to look at it. "And you tell me that that is only 3 hours' work!" he exclaimed, looking at the lawyer. "It is really a marvelous achievement." "My brother is a very rapid worker," replied Stopford dejectedly. "Yes, but this is not only amazingly rapid, it is in his very happiest vein, full of spirit and feeling. But we mustn't stay to look at it longer." He replaced the canvas on its pins, and having glanced at the locket and some other articles that lay in a drawer, thanked the inspector for his courtesy and withdrew. "That sketch and the color box appear very suggestive to me," he remarked as we walked up the street. "To me also," said Stopford gloomily, "for they are under lock and key, like their owner, poor old fellow." He sighed heavily, and we walked on in silence. The mortuary keeper had evidently heard of our arrival, for he was waiting at the door with the key in his hand, and on being shown the coroner's order, unlocked the door, and we entered together. But after a momentary glance at the ghostly, shrouded figure lying upon the slate table, Stopford turned pale and retreated, saying that he would wait for us outside with the mortuary keeper. As soon as the door was closed and locked on the inside, Thorndyke glanced curiously round the bare, whitewashed building. A stream of sunlight poured in through the skylight and fell upon the silent form that lay so still under its covering sheet, and one stray beam glanced into a corner by the door, where, on a row of pegs and a deal table, the dead woman's clothing was displayed. "There is something unspeakably sad in these poor relics, Jervis," said Thorndyke as we stood before them. "To me they are more tragic, more full of pathetic suggestion than the corpse itself. See the smart, jaunty hat and the costly skirts hanging there, so desolate and forlorn. The dainty lingerie on the table, neatly folded, by the mortuary man's wife, I hope. The little French shoes and the openwork silk stockings. How pathetically eloquent they are of harmless womanly vanity, and the gay, careless life snapped short in a twinkling of an eye. But we must not give way to sentiment. There is another life threatened, and it is in our keeping." He lifted the hat from its peg and turned it over in his hand. It was, I think, what is called a picture hat, a huge, flat, shapeless mass of gauze and ribbon and feather, spangled over freely with dark blue sequins. In one part of the brim was a ragged hole, and from this the glittering sequins dropped off in little showers when the hat was moved. "This will have been worn tilted over on the left side," said Thorndyke, judging by the general shape and position of the hole. "Yes," I agreed, "like that of the Duchess of Devonshire in Gainsborough's portrait."
"Exactly."
He shook a few of the sequins into the palm of his hand, and replacing the hat on its peg, dropped the little discs into an envelope on which he wrote, "From the hat," and slipped it into his pocket. Then, stepping over to the table, he drew back the sheet reverently and even tenderly from the dead woman's face, and looked down at it with grave pity. It was a comely face, white as marble, serene and peaceful in expression, with half-closed eyes, and framed with a mass of brassy yellow hair. But its beauty was marred by a long linear wound, half-cut, half-bruise, running down the right cheek from the eye to the chin.
"A handsome girl," Thorndyke commented. "A dark-haired blonde. What a sin to have disfigured herself so with that horrible peroxide."
He smoothed the hair back from her forehead and added, "She seems to have applied the stuff last about 10 days ago. There's about a quarter of an inch of dark hair at the roots. What do you make of that wound on the cheek?"
"It looks as though she had struck some sharp angle in falling. As the seats are padded in first-class carriages, though, I don't see what she could have struck."
"No. And now let us look at the other wound. Will you note down the description?" He handed me his notebook, and I wrote down as he dictated. "A clean punched circular hole in skull, an inch behind and above margin of left ear. Diameter, 1 7/16. Starred fracture of parietal bone. Membranes perforated, and brain entered deeply. Ragged scalp wound extending forward to margin of left orbit. Fragments of gauze and sequins in edges of wound."
"That will do for the present. Dr. Morton will give us further details if we want them."
He pocketed his calipers and rule, drew from the bruised scalp one or two loose hairs, which he placed in the envelope with the sequins, and having looked over the body for other wounds or bruises, of which there were none, replaced the sheet and prepared to depart. As we walked away from the mortuary, Thorndyke was silent and deeply thoughtful, and I gathered that he was piecing together the facts that he had acquired. At length, Mr. Stopford, who had several times looked at him curiously, said,
"The post-mortem will take place at 3, and it is now only 11:30. What would you like to do next?"
Thorndyke, who, in spite of his mental preoccupation, had been looking about him in his usual keen, attentive way, halted suddenly.
"Your reference to the post-mortem," said he, "reminds me that I forgot to put the ox-gall in my case."
"Ox-gall?" I exclaimed, endeavoring vainly to connect this substance with the technique of the pathologist. "What were you going to do with—" But here I broke off, remembering my friend's dislike of any discussion of his methods before strangers.
"I suppose," he continued, "there would hardly be an artist color man in a place of this size."
"I should think not," said Stopford. "But couldn't you get the stuff from a butcher? There's a shop just across the road."
"So there is," agreed Thorndyke, who had already observed the shop. "The gall ought, of course, to be prepared, but we can filter it ourselves. That is, if the butcher has any. We will try him at any rate."
He crossed the road towards the shop, over which the name Felton appeared in gilt lettering, and, addressing himself to the proprietor who stood at the door, introduced himself and explained his wants.
"Ox gall?" said the butcher. "No, sir, I haven't any just now, but I am having a beast killed this afternoon, and I can let you have some then. In fact," he added after a pause, "as the matter is of importance, I can have one killed at once if you wish it."
"That is very kind of you," said Thorndyke, "and it would greatly oblige me. Is the beast perfectly healthy?"
"'They're in splendid condition, sir. "'I picked them out of the herd myself. "'But you shall see them, eh, and choose the one you'd like killed.'
"'You are really very good,' said Thorndyke warmly. "'I will just run into the chemist's next door and get a suitable bottle, "'and then I will avail myself of your exceedingly kind offer.' "'He hurried into the chemist's shop, from which he presently emerged, "'carrying a white paper parcel, "'and we then followed the butcher down a narrow lane by the side of his shop. "'It led to an enclosure containing a small pen, "'in which were confined three handsome steers,' whose glossy black coats contrasted in a very striking manner with their long, grayish-white, nearly straight horns.
"'These are certainly very fine beasts, Mr. Felton,' said Thorndyke as we drew up beside the pen, "'and in excellent condition, too.'
He leaned over the pen and examined the beasts critically, especially as to their eyes and horns. Then, approaching the nearest one, he raised his stick and bestowed a smart tap on the underside of the right horn, following it by a similar tap on the left one, a proceeding that the beast viewed with stolid surprise.
"'The state of the horns,' explained Thorndyke as he moved on to the next steer, "'enables one to judge, to some extent, of the beast's health.'
"'Lord bless you, sir,' laughed Mr. Felton. "'They haven't got no feeling in their horns.' "'Else what good their horns be to them?'
"'Apparently he was right, "'for the second steer was as indifferent to a sounding rap on either horn as the first. "'Nevertheless, when Thorndyke approached the third steer, "'I unconsciously drew nearer to watch, "'and I noticed that as the stick struck the horn, "'the beast drew back in evident alarm, "'and that when the blow was repeated, "'it became manifestly uneasy.'
"'He don't seem to like that,' said the butcher. "'Seems as if... Hello, that's queer!'
Thorndyke had just brought his stick up against the left horn, and immediately the beast had winced and started back, shaking his head and moaning. There was not, however, room for him to back out of reach, and Thorndyke, by leaning into the pen, was able to inspect the sensitive horn, which he did with the closest attention, while the butcher looked on with obvious perturbation.'
"'You don't think there's anything wrong with this beast, sir, I hope?'
"'I can't say without a further examination,' replied Thorndyke. "'It may be the horn only that is affected. "'If you will have it sawn off close to the head and sent up to me at the hotel, "'I will look at it and tell you. "'And, by way of preventing any mistakes, "'I will mark it and cover it up, "'to protect it from injury in the slaughterhouse.' He opened his parcel and produced from it a wide-mouthed bottle labeled ox gall, a sheet of gutta-percha tissue, a roller bandage, and a stick of sealing wax. Handing the bottle to Mr. Felton, he encased the distal half of the horn in a covering by means of the tissue and the bandage, which he fixed securely with the sealing wax.
"'I'll saw the horn off and bring it up to the hotel myself with ox gall,' said Mr. Felton. "'You shall have them in half an hour.'
He was as good as his word, for in half an hour Thorndyke was seated at the small table by the window of our private sitting-room in the Black Bull Hotel. The table was covered with newspaper, and on it lay the long gray horn and Thorndyke's traveling-case, now open and displaying a small microscope and its accessories. The butcher was seated solidly in a armchair, waiting, with a half-suspicious eye on Thorndyke, for the report. And I was endeavoring by cheerful talk to keep Mr. Stopford from sinking into utter despondency, though I, too, kept a furtive watch on my colleague's rather mysterious proceedings. I saw him unwind the bandage and apply the horn to his ear, bending it slightly to and fro. I watched him as he scanned the surface closely through a lens, and observed him as he scraped some substance from the pointed end onto a glass slide, and having applied a drop of some reagent, began to tease out the scraping with a pair of mounted needles. Presently he placed the slide under the microscope, and having observed it attentively for a minute or two, turned round sharply.
"'Come and look at this, Jervis,' said he.
I wanted no second bidding, being on tenterhooks of curiosity, but came over and applied my eye to the instrument.
"'Well, what is it?'
he asked.
"'A multipolar nerve corpuscle.' "'Very shriveled, but unmistakable. "'And this?'
"'He moved the slide to a fresh spot.
two pyramidal nerve corpuscles, and some portions of fibers.
And what do you say this tissue is?
Cortical brain substance, I should say, without a doubt.
I entirely agree with you. And that being so, he added, turning to Mr. Stopford, we may say that the case for the defense is practically complete.
What in heaven's name do you mean? Exclaimed Stopford, starting up.
I mean that we can now prove when and where and how Miss Grant met her death. Come and sit down here, and I will explain.
No, you needn't go away, Mr. Felton. We shall have to subpoena you.
Perhaps, he continued, we had better go over the facts and see what they suggest.
And first we note the position of the body, lying with the feet close to the offside door, showing that, when she fell, the deceased was sitting, or more probably standing, close to that door. Next, there is this. He drew from his pocket a folded paper, which he opened, displaying a tiny blue disc. It is one of the sequins with which her hat was trimmed, and I have in this envelope several more which I took from the hat itself. This single sequin I picked up off the rear end of the offside footboard, and its presence there makes it nearly certain that at some time Miss Grant had put her head out the window on that side. The next item of evidence I obtained by dusting the margins of the offside window with a light powder, which made visible a greasy impression 3 1/4 inches long on the sharp corner of the right-hand jamb. Right hand from the inside, I mean. And now, as to the evidence furnished by the body. The wound in the skull is behind and above the left ear, is roughly circular, and measures 1 7/16 inches at most, and a ragged scalp wound runs from it toward the left eye. On the right cheek is a linear, contused wound 3 1/4 inches long. There are no other injuries. Our next facts are furnished by this. He took up the horn and tapped it with his finger, while the solicitor and Mr. Felton stared at him in speechless wonder. You notice it is a left horn, and you remember that it was highly sensitive. If you put your ear to it while I strain it, you will hear the grating of a fracture in the bony core. Now, look at the pointed end, and you will see several deep scratches running lengthwise, and where those scratches end, the diameter of the horn is, as you see by this caliper gauge, 1 7/16 inches. Covering the scratches is a dry blood stain, and at the extreme tip is a small mass of a dried substance which Dr. Jervis and I have examined with the microscope and are satisfied is brain tissue.
Good God! Exclaimed Stopford eagerly. Do you mean to say?
Let us finish with the facts, Mr. Stopford, Thorndyke interrupted. Now, if you look closely at that blood stain, you will see a short piece of hair stuck to the horn, and through this lens you can make out the root bulb. It is a golden hair, you notice, but near the root it is black, and our caliper gauge shows us that the black portion is 1 4/64 inches long. Now, in this envelope are some hairs that I removed from the dead woman's head. They also are golden hairs, black at the roots, and when I measure the black portion I find it to be 1 4/64 inches long. Then, finally, there is this. He turned the horn over and pointed to a small patch of dried blood. Embedded in it was a blue sequin. Mr. Stopford and the butcher both gazed at the horn in silent amazement. Then the former drew a deep breath and looked up at Thorndyke.
No doubt, said he, you can explain this mystery, but for my part I am utterly bewildered, though you are filling me with hope.
And yet the matter is quite simple, returned Thorndyke, even with these few facts before us, which are only a selection from the body of evidence in our possession. But I will state my theory, and you shall judge. He rapidly sketched a rough plan on a sheet of paper and continued. These were the conditions when the train was approaching Woldhurst. Here was the passenger coach, here was the burning rick, and here was a cattle truck. This steer was in that truck. Now, my hypothesis is that at that time Miss Grant was standing with her head out of the offside window watching the burning rick. Her wide hat, worn on the left side, hid from her view the cattle truck which she was approaching, and then this is what happened. He sketched another plan to a larger scale. One of the steers, this one, had thrust its long horn out through the bars. The point of that horn struck the deceased head, driving her face violently against the corner of the window, and then, in disengaging, plowed its way through the scalp and suffered a fracture of its core from the violence of the wrench.
This hypothesis is inherently probable, it fits all the facts, and those facts admit of no other explanation. The solicitor sat for a moment as though dazed. Then he rose impulsively and seized Thorndyke's hands.
"I don't know what to say to you," he exclaimed huskily, "except that you have saved my brother's life, and for that may God reward you."
The butcher rose from his chair with a slow grin.
"It seems to me," said he, "as if that ox gall was what you might call a blind, eh, sir?"
And Thorndyke smiled an inscrutable smile.
When we returned to town on the following day, we were a party of four, which included Mr. Harold Stopford. The verdict of death by misadventure, promptly returned by the coroner's jury, had been shortly followed by his release from custody, and he now sat with his brother and me, listening with rapt attention to Thorndyke's analysis of the case.
"So you see," the latter concluded, "I had six possible theories of the cause of death worked out before I reached Halbury, and it only remained to select the one that fitted the facts. And when I had seen the cattle truck, had picked up that sequin, had heard the description of the steers, and had seen the hat and the wounds, there was nothing left to do but the filling in of details."
"And you never doubted my innocence," said Harold Stopford.
Thorndyke smiled at his quondam client.
"Not after I had seen your color box and your sketch," said he, "to say nothing of the spike."
The end.